Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, bright and early on a Sunday morning. And as you're out walking this morning, look over there. Look over there. There may be a rat. Chicago, once again, seventh year in a row, named the rattiest city in America. So why am I talking about this interesting fact on a pet show? Huh? Well, I have good reason to. And Dr. Natalie Marks will be here to explain. Some call her a queen of cat behavior. At least I do. Veterinary behaviorist Dr. Teresa DePorter. At this time of year especially, people are thinking, I've got a cat. Maybe I've got two cats. But maybe I need a third cat. Is that a bad choice? Is that a good choice? What do you think?
I certainly understand why people want to, you know, bring a new cat in and just someone that... It's a new cat to kind of cuddle with and hug for the wintertime. Cats don't necessarily always appreciate another cat in their house. So we do have to be kind of cautious and respectful that cats may not necessarily love a new cat coming into their area.
So cats are actually social, but the thing is they don't make new friends as instantly in general as dogs might. They always don't either. We always don't either. But we're pretty good at it. Very, very, oh, I met you. Oh, nice to meet you. Oh, it's wonderful. I'm going to hug you. Cats aren't quite like that. But over time, they can, not always, but they can get to know one another. In fact, the more time you take, is it the better off your odds are?
I think it can be better. We certainly want to go slowly and don't rush the introduction. Some people are inclined to go, well, let's put them together and see what happens. And I think that, you know, if it goes fine, then you're okay. But if it goes badly, it's very hard to undo that bad first impression. When we talk about cats being, you know, social or not social, the cats are most social to who they meet during their socialization period. So thinking about adding a kitten may be a better addition to a household that has other cats. So a kitten that's under about 12 weeks age may be the best, maybe the easiest adaptation into with new cats.
And of course, I agree, but I say even better in some cases might be two kittens because then they play with one another. And if the third cat, if there is a third, that existing cat, or maybe the two existing cats that interact with one another, then they have a choice. They can join in the fun. Or they could say, hey, I'm too old, I'm out of it, but you guys play with one another. Is that a good, and you're saving two cats also. Is that a good strategy?
Absolutely. I think getting two cats that are in that socialization period as to that, those two bond the best. They may groom each other, and they might snuggle, they might play, and they have the best chance of forming a bond relationship that could last a lifetime.
Especially if they're litter mates already, right?
Litter mates are even just of the same age. They're going to have a much better chance of being, you know, being friends forever. And the older cat, the already existing cat in the household, he may choose just to stay back and to watch them. He doesn't have to join into the. He could be a spectator and sit back, you know, high on a perch somewhere and watch the kittens play. And I think that's a great way to have an extra cat in the household.
All right, so you bring in that cat, the new cat, and how important is this, a closed door? Explain.
Oh, that's a fantastic way to put it, because I think doors are absolutely fantastic tools. And if we can sequester and keep them separated, both for medical and behavioral reasons, the new cat coming in may carry some diseases, may have some parasites, so of course it's really important to get them checked out by the veterinarian as soon as possible. And then behaviorally, cats don't necessarily want to have the sight of another cat. And they stare at each other, and they puff up, and they hiss, and they chase and run. Then we have so much more work behaviorally to overcome that bad first impression.
Are there some things we could do to minimize any anxiety that new cat is feeling and or the existing cat or cats in the household are feeling?
Absolutely. I think we like having the cat that's coming in or cats that are coming in sequestered in an area that can potentially be their part of the house long term. Maybe that will give them a new core base. And then in that area, we want to provide resting areas, their feeding stations, and obviously as far from the feeding station as possible, the litter box area, some scratching posts, some tall places, some sunny places, things like that, so that they can feel as comfortable and as at home as possible in that space. Then when we start to do moving the cats into the rest of the house, it happens just by opening that door. So the resident cat, maybe they get put into a bedroom for a little bit, and then you open the door and let those new cats start to look out and see the rest of their world. But if they become uneasy, they can go back to that home base. So they might, you know, kind of sneak out in the hallway a little bit, look one side or the other, and if they get startled, they're a few steps back to their place that they feel safe and comfortable in.
Are there some
Everyone needs that place they feel safe and comfortable.
Indeed. Are there some products that we can use to also help minimize anxiety a bit?
Certainly. Using pheromones in both sides of that door. So for the resident cat and for the new cats coming in, the Fila Classic is going to be most useful for helping the cats get accustomed to spaces. So a cat being in a new house, in a new room, Fila Way is going to help them feel safe and comfortable in that location. The other product we consider is Fila Way Multicat, which helps cats form social relationships.
And that's exceedingly important. And these are natural products. They're just copies of pheromones or chemicals that cats and dogs and other animals naturally emit. Are there any nutraceutical products that you'd recommend as well? Because today, here's the good news. There are so many of them compared to, say, 5 years ago. But the bad news is there are so many of them. And, I mean, literally, there are hundreds to choose from. Are there any that you say, okay, here's some science to show this actually probably works?
Absolutely. You know, and you know, when I go to the pet stores and look at the shelves and shelves and shelves of options, very difficult to kind of sort out which products are going to be better than others. So we do want to look for products that have had some scientific research, that are companies that are reliable and that we've known for a long time, and that they make very good products for cats.
Such as?
Zokine is one that's very palatable. It comes as a capsule. It's alpha-cazazepine, so it's something that you can open up, and it's a palatable powder that goes on the food, or you can mix it in with other things, and then the cats can eat that. Soliquin, Anxetane, Composure.
Yeah, those
are a number of
yes.
over-the-counter sort of natural products.
Yeah, Anxetane, Composure, you said, and... Zilkine, which is, you were describing, no wonder why cats like it. It's a hydrolyzed milk protein. So, of course, cats are going to like it. Lactose is not a problem with the product, by the way. It's a powder, so they're not literally drinking milk. So, at the end of the day, would it be very, very quickly here, safe to say the more time you take, the better off you are?
Absolutely.
All right.
Go slow. Help them feel comfortable.
Yep, that's the secret to it. And I also say when they do later... weeks later, very often, when they're finally introduced to one another, get some help. So there's another set of hands there to perhaps help you. Introduce them on one side of the room are these cats. The other side of the room is that cat. They don't have to interact with one another. In fact, I say better off if they don't. Give them something like tuna or salmon. Bring in the heavy artillery and do that over and over and over again so they associate only getting salmon or tuna or sardines or whatever it is with the other cats. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And I do like to add to that if one cat likes a elevated resting place. So the high spot on the cat tower or, you know, a little piece of a cat shelf on the wall so that maybe the resident cat can be up in a secure place where they can watch what's going on from a safe distance, and that make them feel comfortable as well.
Well, I say you're veterinary medicine's cat woman. I don't know if she likes that or not, but she's a superhero. That I know. Dr. Teresa DePorter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Chicago's done it again for the 7th year in a row. Orkin has named Chicago the rattiest city in America. How does it feel to go down the rat hole yet again, Dr. Natalie Marks?
Steve, I don't know. I don't know if I could be more proud. I mean, as a Chicago resident, it's certainly nothing to brag about. But as a veterinarian, it's even more concerning.
All right. We'll get to that in a moment. And what's really interesting to me as well is that all over the country, rat numbers have gone up. And the rats have actually done well in the pandemic. They've adjusted. So the restaurants, the many rats in many places, particularly in urban areas, depend on for the trash, you know, that they throw out, the food source that they had. Those restaurants were closed or may be permanently closed, and the rats very quickly said, okay, there's trash elsewhere. Let's go into the neighborhoods. It's as if they sent one another emails all over the country, and that's exactly what has happened. So now, potentially even more exposure with our entire family, including our dogs, with rats. Why is that a concern for you as a veterinarian?
Well, as a veterinarian and a parent, I'm concerned because we know that rats carry a very potentially deadly disease called leptospirosis. And they do just fine with this bacteria. In fact, they walk around and do just like you said they're doing, having picnics and emailing each other about where the good stashes are from the Halloween block parties that just happened. But for our dogs especially, those rodents will urinate this bacteria out into standing water sources. That could be puddles in alleyways, that could be poor draining courtyards, that could be areas of your lawn that are a little more moist than others. And our dogs just have to lick that area, so lick a puddle, or step in it and lick their feet, and then we can potentially have this infection that can cause liver and kidney disease, and when untreated, in some cases, death.
Well, even when treated, you know, if it's not caught early, or if your dog just happens to get very, very sick, I understand and believe it can be very challenging.
It can be. This is a disease, and just like with so many others in veterinary medicine and human medicine too, the earlier we can detect it and the more aggressive we can treat it, the better success we have. So right now, the odds are, with early detection and aggressive treatment, there's about an 80% survival rate. So that's pretty good, but it's not great, right? Because there's a certain number of dogs, like you mentioned, that even when we do detect the disease and even when we start therapy, they may be an advanced kidney disease that we can't turn around.
Yeah, that's right. And we don't want our dogs to suffer, and they do suffer when they get this very often if they're one of those unlucky ones, not to mention the cost of treating all this. And the amazing thing is it can all be avoided.
Well, that's the thing. You know, for us, prevention is always the best medicine. And this is a disease that we can do a lot of great things to prevent in our dogs. And I didn't even mention, which I know you're going to get to, Steve, because we talk about this a lot, the risk to the family of your dog having this disease. But for dogs specifically, there are really great targeted and safe vaccines that you can talk to your primary veterinarian about to make sure that your dog is a candidate, and talk about your risk factors and your daily life for your dog, and make sure that you understand what this vaccine is doing and, of course, why we're giving it.
And not only are you protecting your dog, and some dogs have no symptoms. I mean, there are no signs of disease. They seem to do okay. But other dogs, as we've talked about, actually succumb to this. And, you know, all of that can be prevented. But we're also talking about the health of the community, because at least one vaccine prevents urinary shedding, which is a fancy way that the dogs of saying the dogs can't spread it to other dogs.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it's one of my favorite terms, and it's community immunity. That's what we're trying to create here. We often think of herds, especially as veterinarians, we think of herds being the large animal medicine that some of my colleagues practice, with cattle and sheep and swine and even horses, so to speak. But we have quote-unquote herds in small animal medicine, too, because if you go to any busy Chicago dog park on the weekend in the summer, it's a very active pack of dogs of all different breeds and all different areas of the city mixing together. So it's exactly what you said. There is a subset of dogs that act just like the rats. They act healthy, but they can carry this bacteria and shed it in their urine and then spread it to other dogs that are around them in the exact same way I mentioned. So yes, when we're talking about vaccines, and especially the one you mentioned that prevents urine shedding, in fact, we're not only protecting your dog, we're protecting a community of dogs.
Right. And maybe your other dog at home, if you have another dog. Of course, a vaccine for all the dogs in your house makes the most sense. But it's not only dogs. So tell me what happens if you have a toddler and if there is a dog without vaccination, a dog that is unvaccinated for leptospirosis that happens to have, for whatever reason, an accident in the house and the toddler crawls through it. Or you clean up that accident and don't wash your hands properly even as an adult. Or those spaces in the grass you talked about that remain wet. And the dogs do what they do in the grass, right? I mean, they're supposed to do that in the grass. And the dog goes ahead and does it. It rains the next day, but your toddler walks through, or toddles, is that the correct term, crawls over the grass and then puts the hand to mouth, as very young children will do. Tell me then, these scenarios don't happen every day, but they happen. Tell me what happens or what can happen.
Yeah, and those scenarios were, my shoulders were rising and I was cringing my face, because that's a parent's worst nightmare and a veterinarian's worst nightmare, because what that puts us in place of risk is zoonotic disease, which is transfer of an animal disease to a human. So just like we mentioned with the dog shedding bacteria in the urine, this is a case where the toddler can put the hand into that wet space, put their hand in their mouth, as you mentioned, somebody cleaning it up, not wearing gloves and eating lunch, not using great hygiene, someone who's immune suppressed, who may be even trying to do good hygiene, but has cuts on their hands or other aspects of what we call a port into the body, an access place into the body. Those are all places where leptospirosis bacteria can get into the human and cause very similar disease. So again, that's called zoonotic disease, and that's something that, as veterinarians, we're public health officials. We are responsible not just for the health of your pets, but also protecting you, the family members, from these animal diseases that can transfer over to humans. The same thing that I worry about when I practice, because veterinarians are a high-risk group of people for transmission of this disease when we're working with patients. So again, another big reason why vaccination is just so important with this disease.
Yeah, lots of reasons for it. And unfortunately, more exposure in the Chicago area, perhaps, than other cities around the country. As for the seventh year in a row, at least according to Orkin, we are the rattiest city in America. But one thing I do love is going down the rat hole with Dr. Natalie Marks. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
I signed up to do it. I mean, I think it's my civic duty to do this, and not everyone can. If you travel to certain places in the world, they won't let you do it. If you have certain physical issues going on with you or taking certain medications, I'm talking about giving blood. And I was more than happy to do it. But what about our pets? Our pets sometimes are in accidents or may be undergoing some sort of surgery where there's bleeding involved and they need blood. Where do they get that blood from? They get from donor pets. And there's a need for that as well. So ask your veterinarian if you're interested in doing that. In California, they do that entirely differently. Well, until now. Things are changing, and that's good. It's called the California Pet Blood Bank Modernization Act. And here's why it's good. Currently, in California, for blood for pets, what they do is they go to the facilities. And there are several facilities that they choose from where the dogs are kept only for the sole purpose of giving blood. What's more, the way the laws are written currently, there's no transparency whatsoever as to how these facilities are treating the dogs. And some have questioned how these dogs are being treated on a day-to-day basis, whether they're getting the kind of enrichment they should, etc. But also the bigger issue is, what kind of life are they living? Even if they're treated reasonably well, here they are, locked up in a facility, in a cage within that facility. The people that care for them probably do the best they can for them. They're fed well. But do dogs deserve better? And is that really a good enough reason to keep dogs in such a place? Because we know the other 49 states do it differently, and by people like you saying, okay, I volunteer my dog to give blood. They do that, and it succeeds in 49 other states. Well, now California will finally have a chance to succeed at this as they finally change their law, and it's called, and they're going to do what every other state does beginning next year, and it's called the Pet Blood Bank Modernization Act, which I'm very happy about. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, right here on WGN.